Today we're talking with Ralph Metzner, pioneer in psychedelics and consciousness research. Dr. Metzner is a psychotherapist, author, and he's one of a trio of well-known researchers, along with Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who conducted research on LSD and other psychedelics at Harvard in the 1960s. Dr. Metzner is here in Santa Fe for the launch of a new book about a man who's been very important in his life, Dr. Albert Hofmann. The book, Mystic Chemist, The Life of Albert Hofmann and His Discovery of LSD, is a biography of the Swiss scientist who first discovered how to isolate LSD and that it had hallucinogenic effects. Dr. Metzner, welcome to Radio Cafe.
Thank you for inviting me. Yes, I'm here.
You are here for the launch of this book, which was published by a Santa Fe Press, Synergistic
right.
Press.
Mm-hmm.
And you will be appearing at Collected Works tomorrow at 5
right.
to talk about the book.
Yes, and also to talk about my own recent book that's appeared and that's part of a series of books that I'm writing on the areas of consciousness.
And the name of that book?
The name of that book is Worlds Within and Worlds Beyond. Worlds Within and Worlds Beyond.
And that was also published recently?
That's published independently by the Green Earth Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that I'm associated with, that I founded. It's devoted to ecology and consciousness, subject like that.
Great. Can you tell us how... I think I'll start by asking you more about Dr. Hofmann, the
yes.
subject of the book that's being launched at...
Right.
How did you first meet Dr. Hofmann?
Since I was one of the researchers working with exploring the potentials of psychedelics, so he was and always has been a kind of guiding elder of that movement of scientists and researchers over the last 50, 60 years since the discoveries of what could be called the consciousness kind of revolution that took place in the 60s. Of course, his work was even earlier on LSD was discovered in the 50s, so... And emerged sort of out of the pharmaceutical, chemical, medical research circles around Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company in Basel, Switzerland, and in the 60s kind of exploded into the subculture through the fact that the drugs were manufactured underground and distributed widely underground to the extent that... Eventually, they all became illegal, which they weren't initially, and they weren't when we were researching them at Harvard.
And you truly were one of the pioneers of psychedelic research in the United States.
Well, I worked with Leary, and there was medical pharmaceutical company and the that were doing research before that, as well as the CIA and the Army Intelligence were doing their research with it. And Leary had the idea that this drug was so important, it was much more important than just with keeping it within a new psychotherapy tool, which I agreed with, even although, you know, it did lead to the drug becoming kind of a mass phenomenon. But the significance of the drug is such that it really couldn't be stuffed into the limited framework of simply another pharmaceutical medical drug for... clinical patients. It's not just for clinical patients, not for people for therapy, although it can be and has been used for therapy. But since it expands consciousness in a generic way, it has profound implications for the way we think about the world. And Albert Hofmann understood that right from the beginning. He was basically a philosopher, a life philosopher, and that's why the title of the book, Mystic Chemist, is very appropriate. He had mystic visions as a child, long before he, you know, knew anything about the possibility of drugs accidentally triggering mystical visions, which nobody knew anything about. It was a completely surprising discovery for science.
And the way he discovered it is quite interesting. It was accidental.
Yeah, as I mentioned, it was like an accidental sort of serendipity in a highly unlikely kind of way. I mean, he's a pharmaceutical Swiss chemist. He's probably the most careful and cautious and meticulous people. So for there to be an accidental ingestion of a chemical that he was working on is like extremely unlikely. But nevertheless, it happened. Perhaps one of the reasons is that it's a drug that has such extreme potency, meaning such a tiny little amount functions to produce profound changes. It's by far the most potent drug that's ever been discovered in any field, because that doesn't mean it's the difference between potency and power. Power means what effect, the depth of the effect can produce. But the potency means how little of the quantity you need, you see. So it's about 1,000 times more potent than the next drugs like mescaline that also affect consciousness in a visionary way. And then the interesting thing that what happened was that these drugs, both of them, you know, have a history, a kind of an underground history in previous cultures where mescaline was a part of the peyote cactus, and then psilocybin, which Hoffman also discovered or synthesized, has the whole history of the magic mushrooms of ancient Mexico that still existed in small areas in Mexico to this day. And LSD may itself have a history as part of some kind of an ergot preparation that was used in Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece. So there are a lot of incredibly interesting scientific and historical and philosophical issues associated with this chemist. That's why it can't just be regarded as another interesting pharmaceutical drug.
Right. And when you first came to Harvard, did you think you would be involved in this sort of research?
Did what? I'm sorry?
When you first came to Harvard, did you, as a graduate student?
No, it was a complete surprise to me, as it was to Albert Hofmann when he discovered the drug. I was just a regular psychology graduate student, studying psychology at the way it was at Harvard at the time, which was kind of behaviorist. But then Timothy Leary was one of my professors, so he had the occasion, and he also was, a standard kind of behaviorist psychologist with an interest in personality testing. But on a vacation, somebody gave him these mushrooms to ingest in Mexico, and then it changed his life completely. He had one experience from that point on. And the same thing happened to me, and the same thing happened to several dozen of my colleague graduate students and other professors, and just at Harvard, and then, of course, similarly in other parts of the world.
And on the West Coast, too.
On the West Coast, too, yes. On the West Coast, there were researchers and psychiatric researchers in Los Angeles and other places. And then in the 60s also, there were people that started manufacturing underground, so because people in the underground who wanted to use it, who weren't part of a psychiatric research establishment, couldn't get it. And so underground chemists figured out how to make it themselves and distribute it and started that whole wave to the great alarm of the regular medical pharmaceutical establishment, but once the genie was out of the bottle, it was out of the bottle.
And to the great alarm of the Harvard administration as well.
Yeah, the Harvard administration. Although the first couple of years that we were there, we were working with psilocybin, and we were doing an approved research project with support of the drug from Sandoz Pharmaceutical, and it was as I say, it was a research project. We did a research project with prisoners in a maximum security prison, giving them these substances, which we took with them in a cooperative kind of relationship to see if we could provide insight that would allow them to bring about behavior change that would reduce the recidivism rate. So we did those kinds of studies. We did studies of giving the substance to various other people in literature, in the arts, in politics, and to understand it, because these were something that was completely new, that was totally out of the realm of possibility and expectation that psychologists would have any idea about. So it was really field research, as if discovering a whole new continent, and developing the language. But we wrote up the studies and published the studies in the journals, just like social scientists are supposed to do. There was one study that was done on religious mystical experience, where LSD was given to people theology students as part of a, while they were attending a divinity service, and that was written up as an experiment and published, conducted by an MD, PhD.
And you you found quite positive results when you work with prisoners,
for example. Yes, the prisoner project, they made profound changes. It was difficult to prove that the recidivism rate changed because, you know, people go into jail and when they get released from jail, they go back into their way of life. Changing behavior in a long range is not as easy as changing consciousness, but changing consciousness is the first step. So,
what happened? What happened to take that moved the study of psychedelics outside? I'm sure it's still studied in academia, but the research kind of became less known, and the counterculture usage.
The research became because of the explosion into the popular counterculture, underground culture. And this was the mid-60s, after all. There were revolutions going on in all kinds of fields, in civil rights, in the environment, in the women's movement, not to mention the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement. So there was that whole period of the 60s was a movement of profound social, psychological, and political upheaval, as we all know, the effects of which are still reverberating in our day. People taking these consciousness-expanding drugs, that was one element of it. It was not at all, some could say it was kind of a catalyst, but it certainly wasn't the only thing that was happening. You know, there are many people working towards really changing society and changing the worldview who never even came near the drugs at all. But it was an element in that whole thing. And so the culture was then in a situation of finding, then we need to find some other way. If it's not going to be just contained in the medical pharmaceutical way, then what is it going to be? And, of course, then laws were passed to make all these drugs illegal. So they all became illegal, basically. And so research came to a stop completely for about 40 years. And it's only now, in the last 10 years, actually re-emerging in the laboratories and clinics, and the LSD being used for treatment of obsessive-compulsive disorder, and MDMA being used in the treatment of PTSD and those kinds of things. But, of course, the underground has existed all along.
Right.
So if you think of the total number of people taking psychedelics, the people taking them in the context of a research project will maybe be 1%. There may be a couple of dozen people doing that, participating in a research project. In the meantime, there's several thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who use the same exact drugs in all kinds of contexts. And, of course, there are difficulties associated with that because the drugs are produced underground. They're not necessarily very pure.
Right.
But nevertheless, some of them are. There are chemists who know how to make it. Most of these drugs are not that difficult to make for somebody with, you know, has the wherewithal. So, but it is kind of interesting. So I go to these research meetings where psychologists and doctors and researchers are reporting on the research and finding new positive results. Like, think about PTSD war veterans who've
right.
been traumatized. So maybe a dozen or a couple of dozen of people have. But if a veteran comes and says, "Okay, sign me up, I'd like to have it," they can't get it. The only way they can get it would be on the underground, because the research doesn't mean it's available for a doctor to hand out.
And with marijuana,
there's 450,000 veterans with PTSD walking around.
With marijuana being more accepted as a treatment for, or a potential treatment for PTSD, perhaps LSD will also be
right.
to be
exactly
accepted.
That there is now, you know, for the beginning of a softening stance. It's a new generation of people, younger people who have not been, you know, conditioned with the same thing, and who maybe experimented. Our president experimented with marijuana in his youth, right? He said,
right.
You know, he said, I thought that was the point, after all. So there's a little bit of a softening, and there's a little bit of the enforcement agencies are now saying, okay, no, we're not going to go after marijuana growers, after all. And marijuana is a beneficent herb that's got a thousand-year history in many cultures. That's never has a single fatality been reported from the use of marijuana. Never, ever. And, you know, the psychiatric drugs that are being marketed all the time, they produce fatalities all the time. Dozens of them every year. And yet another new drug, So I think people are waking up to the fact that there's no reason not to go with substances that have a proven track record of an ancient history.
Which, of course, is what Dr. Hoffman always intended.
Which, well, Hoffman was a chemist, and he was a journeyman chemist, and he was doing his work, and he accidentally discovered, like, this most profound thing. And so then, but he had the wisdom to recognize that this has much greater implications than just, you know, just another chemical for a psychiatrist. But, you know, he was not in the, he was a researcher, so he made his findings public, but he did not get involved as a political figure in that movement. So he was kind of the wise elder, and so you know, in the last 30, 40 years of his life, he lived to the age of 105, for Pete's sake. So that people and researchers, myself included, many, many people. So the book is really a compilation of interviews and passages and writings about how his work and his discoveries impacted life in all these different aspects, science, the arts, culture, history, society, like that. So
it's almost a history of LSD as much as it is, and psychedelics as much as it is of Dr. Hoffman.
Of Dr. Hoffman, and of the wider socio-cultural transformation movements, which are global. So people from all parts of the world, all parts of Europe, United States, who were deeply affected by his discoveries, and then in the last 30, 40 years of his life, used to come and visit him, myself included. You know, I used to regularly go when I was in Europe and converse with him, learn with him. He was a good friend and mentor and kind of not a spiritual guide, not a guru. I remember when he came and gave a talk at the University of Santa Cruz, and you know, he was given a standing ovation the minute he walked in the door, and then he said, hastened to say, well, I'm not a guru, I'm just a chemist. You know, who accidentally, he always emphasized that, accidentally, while doing something else, stumbled across this drug, which has, you know, implications that go way beyond psychiatry and medicine and chemistry.
Did you ever experience LSD or another psychedelic with Dr. Hoffman?
I met many, many times with Dr. Hoffman. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay. And tell us how has this... This was quite early on in your career that you worked with Timothy Leary and
right.
the man later known as Ram Dass.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How did that shape your career and
well,
change the way you studied?
I was a psychology graduate student at Leary, and you know, I've been a psychologist and psychotherapist, and I've worked with these substances as long as that was available and possible, and I also. You know, and I worked with other substances like MDMA that was discovered in the 70s and was available for a psychotherapy drug, you know, long before it was made illegal. I mean, I've twice in my life had the interesting kind of strange experience of working with a very promising substance in my work. And then after a while, not due to my or anybody else's helpful discoveries, for other reasons having to do with political reasons, not having to do anything with the value of the drug itself, the drug suddenly became illegal. And so I would be a felon, you know, if I continued doing that. So
MDMA is back in the news, as you know.
What? MDMA, yes.
Yes. How do you feel about its use today among young
MDMA
people?
MDMA is actually, I think, the most useful drug for therapy that's ever been discovered. Actually, I think more useful than LSD for purposes of therapy. Particularly special therapy for traumatic things, because the difference from LSD and the psychedelics is it doesn't give you visions, it doesn't change your perception of reality. It just provides you an easy opening at the heart level, at the emotional level, a kind of a balanced perspective where you can just look at things without getting all stressed out and see them as they are. So for somebody who's PTSD, who's been in a war or in an accident where they've seen a lot of blood and bloodshed and horrible life-threatening things, they don't need to have visions and hallucinations. They need to be able to look at reality with equanimity. It's that I called it empathogenic, generating a state of empathy where you can just look at things and say, this is how it happened, And I feel the pain of it, but it's, I have a balance, and I don't, you know, don't overreact to it. I remember I worked with one traumatized veteran, and he was in a state of panic all the time. And so when he took the drug, he was able to accept the fact that during the war in Vietnam, then he was in a state of terror all the time because he could be killed any time of the day or night in a surprise attack. And he had never been able to admit that. Because when you're in the military, you're not supposed to admit that you're afraid. You know, you're supposed to just suck it up.
Right.
And so for the first time when he took MDMA, he was able to cry. It completely softened his heart. And then he was able to admit and talk to himself and talk to his wife and his family about all the things that he had seen. Mm-hmm. And then he became an activist within the Veterans Peace Movement, Veterans for Peace,
okay.
A movement that goes and talks to other soldiers who are being enrolled and says, yeah, maybe you'll get enrolled, but you should know what the reality of war is. So I think it was a very profound kind of transformation from somebody who's a warrior. He's still a warrior, but he's working for peace.
If someone were interested in finding out more about studies and being involved in trials of psychedelics and their effects on PTSD and other conditions, where would they start?
Well, there is an organization called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, that is a nonprofit educational organization. And there's another group called HEFTER. They both are sponsors and organizers of research projects in the application, the positive applications of these substances in the sciences, in the medicine and therapy and so forth. But it's like unlike any other drug research because it's not funded by drug companies. The drug companies are totally uninterested in so not only do they have to do the research and get all the permission to do the research, then they also have to raise the money and get the drugs manufactured and provided to the researchers that can do that. I'm myself more of a social scientist, so I'm interested in that research, of course, but also in the social aspect and the sociological aspect of the fact that this underground movement exists, and not only in the use of these drugs, mind-expanding drugs, but other consciousness-expanding methods, such as derived from yoga and different forms of psychotherapy, and ancient methods of working with the mind in new ways. So it's an interesting situation, you know, where basically scientists get together and discuss the possible therapeutic uses of a substance that basically is unavailable.
Right.
And so from a kind of social, sociological point of view, this is a very unusual. There's no other situation like that. I mean, if they go and scientists want to go and discuss tranquilizers and Valium or whatever it may be, then first of all, the scientists are not interested in taking those drugs themselves, and they're not interested in listening to people's accounts of experiences. See, that's the difficult thing for people to understand. People say, well, what do these drugs do? You can't really say what they do. Because what they open the mind, and so whatever the mind is doing, that's what you will be doing. So, of course, they can be misused. And, of course, MDMA is also just, it's used for therapy of PTSD, but it's also used by people who want to just dance. They call it ecstasy. They give it a different name. They just want to dance. They're not doing therapy.
Right.
So, as Leary had this formula of the set and the setting, you see, the intention and the context is the crucial thing. And for these drugs, that's even more true than any other drug.
I think people should definitely read the new book, Mystic Chemist, The Life of Albert Hofmann and His Discovery of LSD. There's also a great book that I looked at in which Gary Bravo interviewed you and the man we now call Ram Dass.
And Ram Dass, yes.
About your experiences, which I thought was great.
And
then your new book as well.
Yes.
And I think that you will be talking about all of this at Collected Works tomorrow.
I will, yes.
And
Collected Works bookstore. We'll be talking about that. Birth of a Psychedelic Culture, Mystic Chemist, and my new book, The Worlds Within and Worlds Beyond. I look forward to that.
I think I'll attend as well, and I hope the audience does. It's at 5 o'clock at Collected Works tomorrow, 202 Galisteo. For more information, call 988-4226. And I just want to thank you so much, Dr. Metzner. I wish we had more time because you're very interesting and have lots to say. Yes. But people can ask you questions, I'm sure, and hear and learn more about you tomorrow.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much for being with us. That was thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Ralph Metzner. He is a pioneer in consciousness research and psychedelics, and he will be speaking, as I just said, at Collected Works tomorrow. We're going to take a break now. We will be right back with more Radio Cafe and Speaking of the Arts with Rob DeWalt.